If you really want to understand critical race theory, you have to go back in time.
Their mission was to reestablish white domination, and they did that by monitoring every book in every classroom in the South.
From the African American Policy Forum, I'm your host, Kimberly Crenshaw. This is the United States of Amnesia, a miniseries explaining what CRT really is and what our reaction to it says about America's future. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Immigrantly listeners. Just a heads up. Today's episode covers sensitive topics, including addiction, self-harm, and attempt at suicide. Please take care while listening. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Immigrantly. I am Sadia Khan. I'm really excited about today's episode because we have two incredible guests joining me, one of whom you might already know if you've been with us for a while. Shahjahan Khan was my co-host from our season on love and relationships, and he's back. Since we last talked, Shahjahan has been making big moves in the entertainment world, from appearing on TV shows like Succession to stepping into some iconic roles in video games like Mortal Kombat. I am so excited to catch up and hear what's been going on in his life. Joining Shahjahan is Rafi Rashid, an experimental musician who's been making waves with his raw confessional style. Today, we'll talk about Rafi's music, but beyond that, his personal journey. Rafi's story is one of resilience, transformation, and healing. And I am so honored that he's chosen Immigrantly to share his story with all of us. We are going to explore how his experiences have shaped his music and his advocacy for sobriety in the arts. Oh, and by the way, before we dive in, don't forget to subscribe to Immigrantly's channel on Apple Podcasts. We have 5 incredible podcasts with more in development. Your support will go a long way. Subscribe for as low as $3.99 per month, guys, for ad-free content. How wonderful is that? So don't forget to do that. And now let's jump in and have a conversation that's as real as it gets. Welcome to Immigrantly. Shahjahan, welcome back.
Thank you.
You know, I was talking about the time that we spent doing a season of Immigrantly on love and relationships. It was so much fun. I'm sure you learned some. I learned a lot. We were really deep into those conversations. From that to where you are now, tell me, what's been going on?
A lot of stuff, a lot of like acting related stuff, a lot of music related stuff, which is kind of what brings us to today's conversation. But yeah, it's been like a really cool couple of years. Very, very thankful.
We'll start with music because that's your first love, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think even when we were doing our season 13 of Immigrantly, like you said, I had that year or the year before started to play with my really good friend and bandmate, Rafi Rashid, and his band, Ravi Shavi. My band, Gaminas, had kind of been winding down, and it was kind of like post-pandemic and stuff. And then I just linked up with an old friend of mine. I forget if, you know, I sent him a message first or maybe he did or something. And then we ended up connecting, not just on that, but on like a personal level too, because, you know, one thing that I've talked about pretty openly on Immigrantly and then also my show, King of the World, was my experience with addiction and mental health. And then when I got in touch with Rafe, who I hadn't seen in a few years, it turned out that he was also getting sober. So in a way, it felt very meant to be at the right time that the two of us would start working together. And things just clicked right away. And I've been annoying him ever since. So.
Is that true?
So annoying. It's really, yeah, I can't get rid of him. He's like a fly just buzzing around the room. No, it's been nothing like that. Just a blessing.
So, Rafiq, talk to me about your story. You were born in Islamabad. You were only 8 when you moved to the U.S. Talk to me about your journey.
I was actually 5 when I moved to the U.S. With my family to Long Island. My father was and still is a psychiatrist, so he got a job here. You know, I was model minority good kind of kid, did everything I could in terms of excelling at school. I was probably a little bit shy. And then, you know, like most 12, 13-year-old boys, I got into skateboarding, I got into punk music, I got into all of that. And at the same time, you know, I had started noticing my friends were gravitating towards using drugs and alcohol to kind of let loose and access their individuality and their sense of independence. So I got into that, of course, as I got a little bit older, like around 15, 16. At first, I found it to be very freeing, kind of empowering thing. And in music, as you know, as Shaj probably knows, and other people in music who have struggled with those substances, those things are especially hard because it's quite rewarded in our culture, in our subcultures of punk and rock and roll to be.
How so?
I think there's a certain connotation in terms of like, there's like an aggressive like release. To the music that is sort of married to like the loss of inhibition that comes with alcohol and other substances. Basically, the crazier you are on stage, the more people are into it. And you know, you look at people like Iggy Pop being an early example, or like Henry Rollins or Gigi Allen to be like a really extreme example of like people, you know, quite literally out of their minds, sometimes lacerating themselves on stage. You know, I would never do that, but trying to have basically as close as I could to like a dance seizure on stage, you know what I mean, was sort of the goal. And that was like, I just remember being like 18, 19, almost passing out at the end of shows because of how physically intense the feeling was, letting that energy get summoned, but then also like obviously feeling the effects of alcohol and weed and amphetamines and things like that. It felt like I ran 10 marathons and like did a boxing match. At the end of a set, I was out of breath. My body was just finished.
What was about music that drew you to it?
There was something about just the fact that you could manifest something just kind of out of thin air, in the sense that you could really just make your own version of an identity that didn't have anything to do with what people were telling you to be or to become. And that if it was a compelling enough identity and it was a compelling enough experience for people around you, then they would accept you in that way, and that you could really become something unique through music.
So what were people telling you to be, and how did you perceive your identity?
I think when I was younger, you know, you have, of course, I mentioned the model minority thing, right? Like you're coming over Pakistani American, there's a lot of pressure, imagined or real, to become like a professional, becoming a doctor or a lawyer. Even beyond that, there was just a sense that the messages that people get, regardless of their ethnicity, is that you should become something that is along a career path that has a tangible sort of path, in the way that like, okay, you're going to do this one thing, that's your vocation, and you're going to excel at that one thing. So I don't know. I never really responded to that. I always thought life was maybe had a bit more potential than that.
In what ways were you exploring potential?
I was never married to one medium, even like filmmaking when I was a kid. And I like music. And even just within the medium of film, I saw that it had all of these other things. A lot of my heroes growing up were like auteurs in a sense, like Scorsese and Tarantino and Wes Anderson, like these people who felt like they were wearing many different hats on a set. And that was to me metaphorically true just in life. Like, I think it helps to be very interested and very involved in and a lot of different things. So for me, it was music, it was video, it was the art world. As I became like 19, 20, I started working with my cousin more in like exhibitions and gallery spaces and things like that. So I never felt super compelled to just stick to one thing.
You've also talked about your struggles with addiction during this period, right? How have those experiences influenced the themes and emotions in your work?
I think Kitchen Weapons, which is my first solo album that I put out, is the first one to explicitly talk about my experience in addiction. You know, I got sober 4 years ago, and that was my first attempt at it. I was addicted to alcohol and Adderall, which to me are probably the most American ones to get addicted to. There was a sense that this, of course, was going to seep into my work eventually. I think in Ravi Shavi, like my rock and roll band, I would talk about the positive sides of those things a lot or like dance around it. And then this time it became a bit more autobiographical specifically. And that was just out of sheer desperation. When I was 29, so that was the year before I got sober, was when I actually wrote Kitchen Weapons. And I think I had just realized that I'm at the end of my rope. And I think these days are numbered in terms of like being able to actively use. So I figured, why not write about this experience? On a blue afternoon. And then when the album came out, actually in I had already been sober for a year. So it was an interesting experience to put it out as a sober person, having written it as a very not sober person. And I feel complete.
All of my friends evidently have moved. Shahjahan, you've talked about struggles with addiction as well, right? Drug use as teenagers and at that age, and I'm pretty sure it probably wasn't part of your consciousness, but do you think it, in some ways, for both of you, it was a way or a pathway to integrate into American society and to be, quote unquote, that typical American teenager?
I mean, for me at least, it was very normal, and it was very just like, oh, this is what you do now. You drink a little and like, oh, my friend's parents are like cool with it as long as it's at their house and stuff. And oh, it's weird that I'm not supposed to do this stuff or whatever. I think in my case, it became very obviously abnormal pretty quickly. So I was pretty conscious of within the first 5-6 months of me starting to drink and get high, for example. And I'm actually, it's funny, I'm seeing a bunch of my high school friends tonight. They all took me out for an intervention at a Friendly's in Acton, Massachusetts, and were like, bro, you're doing this way too much. And that was with literally, I was like barely 16 years old. So it was very much yet another way that I was different from everybody else. But now, having spent time in Pakistan, also as a young person, being like, oh, people get fucked up here too all the time. So whatever ideas that I had about the way Pakistan is or isn't, were totally wrong.
We get the sanitized version. Yeah. I think the only difference is that in Pakistan, it's still tabooed. People do them all the time, but nobody talks about it, right? So I think maybe that's where it is different from the US. But for you, Rafi, was it a tool for integration?
100%. I was the kid who would circle the track next to the church and the woods in which all my friends used to party, like before I started partying. And they very literally were like, you're not in the club unless you hit this blunt.
Oh my God. Kids are such assholes.
Yeah. And I tried to stave it off for as long as I could. But eventually, you know, I was like, well, I'm literally going in circles around this track. So the woods seem like a fun place to be right now. So definitely. But like Shaj, I also grew up around my family, my dad and his friends drinking and stuff like that. So it wasn't Pakistani versus American for me, but definitely in terms of being as a tool for integration, 100%.
Did you guys ever confide in your family early on?
I didn't confide. I got caught. The first time I really got caught, my parents didn't even leave for the weekend. They went to a shadi like 45 minutes away from where we lived. And I threw a fucking giant party at our house. I invited five friends. They invited five friends. Some the same friends I'm going to see tonight, by the way.
How old were you at the time?
I was like, I don't know, 16 or something. And then they came back early because my mom wasn't feeling well. There was like beer all over the house. There were like bongs and they came back and walked in on this party and like I was out of my mind and that's how they found out. I didn't confide in them until much later about the mental health, you know, the suicidal stuff that came a lot later. Then they became my biggest supporters eventually after we went through that whole shame process. But no, I mean, I didn't confide in them. No way.
But when you did, can you share that conversation with us?
Yeah. So when I left high school, I barely graduated high school. I got to college. I just couldn't get to class. I was, you know, without getting high. I basically just was super suicidal. And I came home and I told them that that's what I'd been feeling. And then, you know, right away, they talked to my childhood pediatrician. And that was the beginning of a very, very long, arduous 8-year attempt to get sober.
You said beyond shaming. Do you think there was initial shaming?
I didn't mean shaming by them. I meant like the shame that we felt as a family because of it, you know, the fact that we would hide it and that like, you know, whereas now it's totally the opposite. Oh, and you know this because you've talked with my mom several times that, you know, they're very open. My mom actually started a mental health group at a masjid and stuff. And so.
Rafi, what about you? Did you ever talk to your family about your struggles?
I think it was apparent for them, I think, through my 20s, but we didn't actually have a serious conversation about it until pretty late and probably about 6 months before I actually got sober. But that was like a huge part of my recovery was getting honest with them because they were also the ones to sort of help support me through, you know, those early days. So I needed to know that I had their back when it was time for me to pull the trigger on my sobriety.
Why did you wait so long?
Like most people who are struggling, there was still hope that it could be managed. And when that hope had run out, that was when it was time to get honest, you know. But I think like most addicts, if you have even a glimmer of hope that you can make it work, you'll pretty much keep going.
You said in one of your interviews, and I quote, "I think the future always holds something better if you're learning from the past." What have you learned from the past?
I have learned that giving up a measure of control is key to allowing opportunities into your life. And so that's a big one for me, is once you kind of can relinquish a little bit of control over every outcome, then outcomes that you haven't even imagined can start to make themselves known to you. So that's a bigger, I guess, more philosophical one. If there are situations that are repeatedly not serving you and are causing you harm, that it's probably good to try to get some help to get out of those situations. So reaching out for help is a big one.
Shahjahan, if I were to ask you the same question, what have you learned from the past?
I mean, I would definitely agree with both of the things that Rafe said. More of on the philosophical, and for me as of late, you just never know what your life has in store for you. This is especially true for somebody like me who has one idea of the kind of person I was supposed to be, what my life was supposed to look like. But when you do stop obsessing about and trying to control, things really do open up for sure. And another lesson from the past is just your feelings aren't facts. And the emphasis of looking at life like a day at a time, it's taken me many, many years to understand exactly what that is and how so many of my issues and problems, not all of them, But a lot of them have to just do with the way that I think about things and the way that I see. And that is something that I do have control over.
So how have you changed your thinking? Give me an example.
Me personally?
Mm-hmm.
If I feel like bummed out and depressed for a couple of days, that doesn't mean that I'm doomed to a life of depression and failure. I can go to very, very dark places, you know, even with all the success that I've had and all the standard stuff that artists get with imposter syndrome and feeling like, you know, I'm not as far along as I should be. But it's just not true because I can reset my day at any point. That was one of the best pieces of advice I ever got. It's like, you know, you could reset your day like right now.
When you go to these dark places, how do you reset? Is there a ritual you follow? Is there something you do, or you just let go of the control, maybe?
It's a combination of all three, and sometimes none of it works, and sometimes you just sit with it. So yeah, I mean, there's things I can say. I've been doing this stuff for a while now. I would like to think that there's like a pattern that I follow and then it works every time, but that's just not the case.
Both of you come from such rich cultural backgrounds, right? And you have explored so many different artistic mediums. How do you stay connected to your roots while evolving as creators?
I think a lot of it for me is speaking in tongues. So my Urdu, for instance, is pretty bad now, even though it was my first language. But by the time I came over, it was all assimilation process. And then you forget Urdu. So I've basically forgotten my mother tongue. So now I'll be in the practice space by myself, just fumbling through Urdu and just seeing kind of what comes out, speaking literally in Urdu tongue and seeing what my unconscious will bring, which has been an interesting process because sometimes I'll ask Shaj and I'm like, is this real Urdu or am I just making this up? And he'll be like, that's kind of right. And so, I don't know, sometimes it's like that, like very concrete way.
Right.
And then I think for me, it's also just recently been branching out and seeing that my roots are part of other people's roots. It's not just Pakistani Americans that I can connect with when we're talking about a larger diaspora coming from other Muslim countries or even non-Muslim countries. Like right now, a big part of connecting with my roots is like connecting with people who are supporting Palestine vocally right now. It's a constant process of seeing who else is connecting with their roots, just seeing if there's some way we can form an alliance.
Identifying that through line, right, of memories and lived experiences, I guess.
Yeah.
Shah Jahan, for you?
I mean, I'm also really lucky to have a huge network of, through the various art that I've been a part of. You know, I was just thinking about in LA, a good friend of mine, Taz, was on Immigrant League. She's like one of the most prolific people I know. She's always doing some things like writing books. So she was doing a book release party at my other friend's coffee shop, who's also Pakistani, Taz is not. And just like the group of people that came to this coffee shop for this reading. You know, I don't live in LA, but just to know that I can just go there for a night and just by virtue of the work that I've done, be connected with all sorts of people across many different diasporas, like Rafe was saying. Because I think for me and him, one thing that I think we maybe didn't touch on was the whiteness of both of our upbringing in a way that like having the very bifurcated thing. So for me, part of the art is like reclaiming that sense of identity.
I want to talk a little bit about your journey because you've been part of Immigrantly Family. You co-hosted a season with me and it's been so amazing to watch your career grow. Like you were on Succession. Tell me, if you look back at the work that you've done since we did season 13, is there anything that would surprise the Shah Jahan that we talked to during our Love and Relationships season?
Anything that would surprise him. Oh my God. I still have the resilience to do what it takes to do this because this is still extremely, look, I'm a full-time artist. I don't have another job. I still don't make a lot of money in any way, by any stretch of the imagination. So just that I haven't, I came close to at the beginning of this year, going back to my 9-to-5 gig that I had post-college. And I was ready to do it. I just was like, I gave it a shot. I was on Succession. It's a weird time in the industry. Maybe that was it for me. And then I booked this other show, Daily Boys, and I was actually booked the play The Kite Runner, which I couldn't go on because of Daily Boys. They gave me more episodes. I was supposed to be the dad in the Broadway version of Kite Runner. So every single acting related dream I ever had has already come true.
What can you disclose about Daily Boys?
Not too much. It's like basically Sopranos for Pakistani Americans. If Tony Soprano was a Pakistani auntie, it's a really cool, very funny, deep kind of show. And yeah, I play a gangster. But it's funny though. It's about these two brothers who inherit their family business where their dad dies. The family business is Deli's Bodega, so it's called Deli Boys. But then it turns out that it's been a front for this criminal underworld.
Very interesting. Rafi, I do want to circle back to your journey with drug use and your recovery, which is so, so, so powerful. How has your music evolved since you decided to get sober?
I think it became a lot less Ford assembly line in my head when I got sober. I think before it was very much like, I'm going to make music every single day and I'm going to come up with a song every single day, because this is my practice and this is how I can optimize my time, which, I mean, now looking back, I can appreciate that ethic, but I can also make a differentiation in my approach now, which is much more like, let me do the work of life and put so much pressure on myself to have all this output all the time and just kind of like slow the whole process down. And so that's why I haven't put a record out that I've written in sobriety yet, because I'm sort of just taking it all in, listening to things, meeting people, going out of town, working on random projects, doing a lot of side things, experimentation. So yeah, right now it's a period of taking things in, taking the world in before I like put stuff back out into it. And to me, I guess that's sort of in a way metaphorical to my approach in life, which was, you know, before I would go out and be like, how can I become the most entertaining and entertained version of myself every night? And it was a lot of pressure, you know, it's putting a lot of pressure to just to go to your local dive bar, you know, for a few hours. But I was like, no, this needs the event of my life. And so everything is now feeling a lot more cumulative as opposed to like this, everything needs to happen today.
Why did you feel the need to entertain?
Maybe that's a larger question, because I think I still feel the need to entertain. It was sort of like I was living without care about the future whatsoever. So I was like, today needs to contain everything. And so if I'm not as entertaining as I can be today, I don't know if I'm going to make it to tomorrow. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know where that came from. I think it might just be hereditary, to be honest.
Do you in any way feel that you have more inhibitions now versus when you were using drugs? Because the way I see it, you were probably using drugs to be unencumbered by those boundaries in a way.
Right.
Do you feel that, or have you found another way to break through those inhibitions?
That's a very good question. I would be lying if I said I don't have more inhibitions when I'm sober. I definitely do. However, I think the way that sobriety has helped me in that regard is that like the inhibitions that I do lose in sobriety, I sort of lose for good. That is kind of nice. I don't have to re-lose them again tomorrow by ingesting a certain X amount of pills or booze. I've just found a way to work through that fear and no longer have that fear.
What message do you hope to share with others who might be going through similar struggles?
A big one for me is that you won't lose yourself and you won't stop having fun. Those were two of my biggest fears. As somebody who loves fun and had a very strong sense of what makes me unique to me, I thought those things were going to go away and that somehow I would get funneled into some sort of assembly line. But yeah, I don't think drugs and alcohol really do that. I have more fun now, and the fun that I do have, I remember. So that's also another big one. In general, that those things don't go away, that you are still going to be you, and you will still manage to have fun.
Do you think in some ways your idea of fun is being redefined through this process?
Yeah, for sure. I still find many of the same things fun. I also realize now that my brain knows intuitively when I've stopped having fun, when I'm sober. And so that's a big thing, is like being able to recognize now, okay, the party is effectively over and like the fun peak has been reached. And now we can go home and do a new peak tomorrow. As opposed to when I was drinking, it was like, we just need to keep raising the peak. And, you know, that's the work of today, is how high can we get this altitude?
Thank you so much for sharing this with us on Immigrantly, Rafi. I really, really appreciate it. And in the end, how would you define the United States of America in a word or a sentence?
I'll say tricky.
Genocidal.
Apt descriptions, guys. Thank you so much. Is there a website where people can go and find your work?
Yeah, super old school, ravishavi.bandcamp.com.
And for me, it's just shahjahanhan.com.
Love it. Thank you so much, both of you. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you, Sadia.
Thank you so much, Sadia. You're the best.
You know, every time I sit down with Shahjahan to have a conversation, I enjoy it thoroughly. If you haven't checked our season about love and relationships, after listening to this podcast, go back and check our episodes. It was one of the most interesting seasons of Immigrantly, and I promise you won't be disappointed. Also, I'm so glad we had Rafi on the show. And you know what? The conversation we had, it wasn't easy for him, but his journey of recovery is so powerful. And I'm so glad that more people are having these conversations. It's important to talk about this stuff so that people who are struggling with addiction, with mental health, can find solace that other people are going through it as well, and it will be okay. Everything will be okay. This episode was produced by me, Sadia Khan, written by me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lena Chang. Our theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week for another Immigrantly episode.